Welcome to The Landscape, a podcast to shed light on the people, programs, and businesses that are changing the landscape for individuals with any type of disability. I'm your host, Nave Eldar. Today's guest, Doug Crandall, is a national subject matter expert on supported employment, with expertise working with individuals with severe mental illness and developmental disabilities. Oh, and he's also an award-winning author, not to mention beating out a former president of the United States as Writer of the Year in Georgia. We speak about that, as well as his work with the University of Georgia and Griffin Hammes Associates. If you are new to the podcast, I hope you subscribe, share with friends, and leave a review on Apple Podcast. Now, today's conversation starts with Doug talking about his work with Griffin Hammes Associates.
I started working with Griffin and Hammes when I was a provider. I wrote a demonstration grant for the Office of Disability Employment Policy for customized employment, and then received something you're an expert in, the IPS grant as well from the Social Security Administration and others at Dartmouth. So, you know, I wanted to do a better job as a provider, and I'd met Kerry Griffin a number of years ago. I've known him about 30 years. And so I started bringing them to Georgia to help me, to help train staff, to help us understand just a different way of doing things. And of course, Kerry's pretty well known for a comment that he makes, and that is that unemployment isn't a flaw in the system. It is the system.
Wow.
And so from the get-go, Griffin Hammes has been focused on saying, why do we do this way? Why do we spend so much money and time and resources on what's wrong with people rather than what's right? And how can we build systems around that? And so Griffin Hammes has been active for over 20 years, as you mentioned. They're in 25 states. So I'm just a consultant for them. My full-time job is at the USET at the University of Georgia, the Institute on Human Development and Disability. But I combine those two and try to make my work in my own state reflect what's going on with Griffin Hammes, and that informs everything that I do then when I go work in other states as well.
When people come to you as a consultant, what do you do? How do you support them?
Well, that ranges from everything from state policy, right? How do you remove barriers, collaborate more, all of those things that we've been doing for a long time, down to working with families, employment specialists on the ground, which is my favorite part. I'm a sibling to a sister with disabilities and have disability and mental health and all that stuff, like most families, by the way, in my life and in my family. And so meeting other people who are trying to navigate a system that is, in my opinion, fairly broken, both on the mental health side and I think on the developmental disability side. And so as I'm doing that, sometimes that work with an individual job seeker or family or provider agency ends up informing what needs to happen at the state level, because those things are very connected, as you well know.
There's a few things that I know, what I think of when I think Griffin Hammes Associates. And one of them is discovering personal genius. I'll let you explain what it is. So what is this service that is provided, and how did it come about?
Well, when people hear the phrase discovering personal genius, they pretty quickly recognize it's an audacious statement, right? And it's probably the best way to capture, right, what we do. In other words, to say that and be working with systems that say, first, we got to figure out what's wrong with you. And then we're going to treat that and bill that and keep billing that for decades instead of saying all of us have strengths. All of us have something that makes us a genius in some area. And do you have to look harder? Of course. I'm certainly an example of that. I think we all are. But it is predicated on this idea of several things. One, setting matters. Where you are, who you're around, how you're treated, how you are motivated impact our performance. But in the disability industrial complex, performance has been viewed through one very tiny lens, and that is productivity. I met a mom once that said, "You don't understand. My son's only 17% productive." What a terrible thing to do to a human being and a mother, to reduce somebody to, by the way, an arbitrary productivity. I'm 0% productive on Excel spreadsheets.
Right.
I'm employed. But in the disability industrial complex, we spend all this time on that. So discovering personal genius is person-centered career planning. It's hands-on. And the way I describe it to families or job seekers is, we want to know you so well, everything, that when we begin to engage an employer, we can tailor that employment situation to you, not the other way around.
Right. I love that, because I was reading specifically your this Discovering Personal Genius and some literature on it, and they said, you know, we want to know you better than what your caregivers think about you, what your main supports think about you. And the reason why I like that is because 99% of the time, if you go to somebody's main support and say, "Hey, what do you think about this person getting a job?" they name a grocery store, or they name, you know, they just, it's just so limiting in their vision, because again, they're thinking of, where have I seen people with disabilities work, instead of, where would this person enjoy working? And so I love that you built this system of really finding what is somebody's interests and skills and all of those things. So love it.
You know, Nave, I was just going to say the Discovering Personal Genius, as we kind of tap out of that, one of my favorite parts in that process is knowing someone's endearing traits. Endearing, the root of that word is beloved, right? Of the heart. And so what gets us jobs? What keeps us employed? It's not the things that we're not great at. It's not any of those things that we consider. It's what we bring to the table when someone says, "I like being around that person because of these endearing traits." And to me, that's so powerful.
Right, right. Something that we've been struggling with, and I say we, there's a small group of us, is self-employment. You know, it's just difficult. It's difficult to wrap your brain around everything you need to know, to getting people up to speed on what it takes to be successful in self-employment. But I know that's something that you also tackle. So can you talk a little bit about how you look at self-employment?
Yeah, I mean, that was a root kind of motivator for Kerry Griffin and Dave Hammes. I mean, they were looking at self-employment for folks that most people wouldn't consider, you know, decades ago. This is older data, but it's from the RSA, Rehabilitation Services Administration's data, that less than 3% of closed VR cases nationally are in self-employment, yet about 30% of Americans have miscellaneous income from self-employment. And so this approach says, you know, maybe my medications impact me in the morning pretty significantly. So I can job develop around that, or I can be my own boss. But just like all the other work that Griffin Hammes has done, it challenges the system, right? It says, maybe if it's a micro enterprise, right? I don't need a 35-page business plan. But vocational rehabilitation is now, I think, much more invested in that on the federal level. And last fall, Griffin Hammes, along with some other organizations, VCU, actually, Virginia Commonwealth University, received funding for a 5-year grant around training vocational rehabilitation systems in self-employment in a new and different way, one that meets the needs of the 21st century. Being self-employed, whether you call it the gig economy or getting your hustle on or whatever it is, we want to make that so that it's available to folks at the same rate as folks who are considered without disabilities. So there's also a great book by Kerry Griffin and Dave Hammes, Making Self-Employment Work for People with Disabilities. It's a great read, very useful as well.
And I know that we're actually going to talk about your other life outside of Griffin Hammes Associates, but you are, so we have providers. I work for under the Medicaid system here in Tennessee, and then we have providers who actually do the services. I'm kind of describing it for the audience. And so those providers have to have certain qualifications, right? We have to be assured that they know what they're doing. And one of the national certifications is through Griffin Hammes. So that's something big that you guys do, is you train people from across the country.
That's right. It's endorsed by an entity called the Association of Community Rehabilitation Educators, ACRE. Right. And we teach the Discovering Personal Genius approach, the informational interview, customized employment and job development, all of that in a curriculum. But where it works best, of course, as you know, Nave, is when you get to do that, you get to think about it and work with a community of practice. But then as you start to implement, you need someone to mentor you, right? Mm-hmm. You need somebody kind of side by side. And I love doing that. In the last 5 years, I've gotten to work in Utah and California, Tennessee, Virginia, Rhode Island, of course, my home state of Georgia. And I think what's so cool about that is you get to learn best practices from other people. Ostensibly, right. I'm supposed to be teaching best practices. But when you come into it with some humility and understanding that the system itself needs all of us to fix it, then I think you can really embrace all of those new skill sets that you can pick up every day, right?
Absolutely right. You know, I am considered a subject matter expert here in Tennessee in supported employment. And sometimes I'll be at trainings and people will say, Nave, how do you know so much? And how do you, and I say every training I go to, I learn something. So it's kind of unfair because I get to learn from people in Memphis and Chattanooga and Nashville, all in small towns, right? And so, like you said, I always go into it thinking I'm going to learn something today too, right? And which will just make me better. And then I can share it with the next training that I do. And I give credit to people. I'll say, hey, I learned this when I was out in Memphis and all that kind of good stuff. So the last thing in Griffin Hammes Associates I wanted to touch on was that I know you also have a focus on financial well-being, because really at the root of all this, we want people to be financially healthy, believe it or not. Like that is the point. It's not for them just to be entertained, right? It's for them to like have life and be able to do things financially. So how do you guys support that?
Yeah, well, you're exactly right. Griffin Hammes has always been rooted in work incentives, training and planning. And even more than that, asset development. You know, you can point to a lot of things nationally that maybe we still need a lot of progress on, but ABLE accounts, truly embracing work incentives, and making sure that people truly have informed choice. Look, one of my pet peeves is when someone says, and you hear this from human service folks all the time, well, they could go to work, but they don't want to lose that check.
Right.
Well, guess what? Neither do you. You wouldn't put your check at risk, and you're asking somebody who makes much less and is having to survive on that amount of money per month to take a big risk. So we really do believe that having true and accessible, concrete information about what it means when I make that decision, and being empathetic that, again, all of us have financial needs and things that we need to consider as we're going to work. And I think we could do as a system just a lot better than what we are now, even with, you know, our work incentives, planning and assistance programs. I think that needs to be much more widespread. And Griffin Hammes often trains Social Security folks on the work incentives that are actually Social Security. So it's not my forte, but it is for Griffin Hammes. And that's a really proud part of the legacy for sure.
Yeah, people really have to check out the website and see everything that Griffin Hammes entails, because it's a lot. It's a name that if you work in this field, especially around support employment, that you know, like everybody knows that name. A name that I did not always associate until the last, 4 or 5 years is your other employer, which is the University of Georgia. So you are with the University of Georgia's Institute on Human Development and Disability, which is, again,
that's correct,
one of the great providers of information and training in the country. And one, how did this land in the University of Georgia in the first place? I don't know if you know that, but I would love to hear about your role there and how the University of Georgia became so big in this.
Well, we're a USET as well. Of course, every state has a USET, a University Center on Excellence in Developmental Disabilities. But I think what people often get wrong is they think that it is only related to developmental disabilities. For 7 years here in Georgia, I acted through the University of Georgia as our state trainer for IPS in mental health, and continue to do that work through IHDD at UGA. But I've been there a little over a decade. I made the decision to leave the provider agency world after 20 plus years and thought I could be of better use in the university setting. And so the way that that works with Griffin Hammes is it just informs everything I'm doing within my own state. So my major role at the University of Georgia is I'm the project director for our state Technical Assistance Center on Best Practices in Employment Supports, advancingemployment.com. So I do training, the ACRE training. I still do IPS training. Often I'll get asked by job seekers and families to help. So next month I'm going to Statesboro, Georgia to help there. We also put out, NAVE, a request for assistance to providers. So each year, one or two providers can fill out a simple application and say, look, we want to build our competitive integrated employment. We want to make that a bigger focus of what we're doing. And so all of that work really is focused on the state of Georgia.
Right.
But as we just mentioned before, a little earlier, it informs everything I do from the other states as well.
And so I believe out of the University of Georgia, there is also this new initiative called Valued Story. Is it out of the University of Georgia?
Yeah.
So can you tell us, what is that initiative?
Yeah, it's called Tell the Valued Story, and you can see it at tellthevaluedstory.com. It came out of, NAVE, to just be brutally honest, our own state agencies have struggled with putting out great stories. And last year, in the fall, they chose to amplify a story about seven folks with the labels of intellectual and developmental disabilities volunteering to pick up trash at Parks and Rec during a global pandemic, and amplified that story to say, this is best practice. And we were deeply disappointed, myself and others at the University of Georgia, but lots and lots of advocates across the state. And we said, why is it, you know, that would be amplified? What's the problem here? And so we formed tellthevaluedstory.com. And essentially, we just got our first dab of funding for it, which is always a thrill. But we will hire self-advocates who've been trained in something from the National Center on Disability and Journalism, which is a great ncdj.org. In collaboration with our staff around, how do you tell a story that's not about a disability label? It's about lived experience, endearing traits, and choosing to amplify the stories that reduce stigma and stereotype across all disabilities and amplify the lived experience. And so our first class of, we hope, about a dozen self-advocates will be trained in June. And they'll be these story auditors who, if I'm a provider and I want somebody from Tell the Valued Story to look at my newsletter, they can look at it, review it, say, hey, this is really good. You're really capturing the valued stories. Or, as in the case I mentioned earlier, you probably shouldn't amplify people volunteering picking up trash. Let's focus on another story. And so it's so needed. And then I guess I'll just say, NAVE, because it's so powerful. So many folks in the mainstream now have gotten to know and read about Judy Heumann's efforts around disability rights and her book Being Human is fantastic. But we really go by her mantra, and her mantra is television, newsprint, bureaucracies still don't understand how to tell the stories, and you must have lived experience within that. So I can't be teaching people about what that means. I've not lived within these bureaucracies. So we hope we're creating a platform where folks who don't get a chance to be heard, one, can be, have the training and skills to do that, and three, be paid for their work and their lived experience. So we're really excited about it, and we'll be writing our first foundation grant here in a couple months.
So how big a scope would you like this to be? Like, these are stories that are going to be told. Are they going to be written? Are they going to be are they going to be short films? Are there going to be news, you know, on television that we'll see? What is the scope?
Well, the scope, as we say, is from the agency newsletter to the front page news. That's why we wanted to incorporate the National Center on Disability and Journalism. That's at Arizona State University at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism. And they've really taken the lead with journalists to say, you know, maybe you don't need to report on somebody's mental illness. It has nothing to do with the story. Mm. Or maybe instead of portraying somebody with the label of Down syndrome as childlike or innocent, or sometimes you'll see this stuff where it's inspirational that somebody in a wheelchair has done something that, you know, it's a commonplace thing to do. So they've really been able to challenge the journalists to do that. But you don't see that in our bureaucracies. Our bureaucracies rarely think about the stories they're telling, from a provider agency to VR, or DD, or mental health agency. So we hope to do a little bit of all of it. And the medium for that will be print and video and storytelling. One of the things we focused on early on is kind of a bridge between tell the valued story and our work and employment. So we've really been focusing on visual resumes. We've got a great filmmaker here named Carl King. Carl's a genius, and he's really been helping us learn about what does a video resume look like? How do you capture those endearing traits? How does that impact then how an employer might view somebody? So we try to connect both of those as we're doing Tell the Valued Story.
I'm going to talk later about how we met each other, which I did not know. You had to remind me through email. We got connected. Yeah, we got connected, and yep, we'll tell that story later. But when we did meet, after you reminded me, one of the things that we connected on is the fact that I have experience on the mental health side with people with severe and persistent mental illness and intellectual and developmental disability, which usually is two separate silos. And so usually somebody has expertise in one or the other. So how in the world did you end up also in both sides of the fence?
You know, that's a great question, Abe. I can only say it's someone named Dr. Steve Hall. Dr. Hall, coincidentally, is retiring this month. He is the policy guy at Griffin Hammes, but he was the DD and mental health commissioner in Kentucky and Georgia and ran provider agencies in Colorado. He hired me when I was 22. I'll celebrate 31 years this fall in this idea of supported employment. And I didn't know what it was. I was the first one to go to college in my family, first generation, you know, factory workers, fast food workers, farmers. That's what I come from. And he must have recognized something and hired me in 1990 to be that, to be an employment specialist. And because he always viewed employment across disabilities, he was already working with community mental health and supported employment while he was directing an agency that was focused on intellectual and developmental disabilities. So I've had a great honor to be able to work across those systems. And as you know, people are people are people. And so label doesn't matter. It's looking for those things that people can contribute. So definitely Dr. Hall set me on that path for sure.
Yes, that is awesome. I love it because you can learn so much from knowing both systems. Because there are different types of supports, and you mentioned individual placement support, for example, which isn't on that's for the mental health side, but they have elements that are very helpful for anybody.
That's right.
So to be able to bring it to the the other side is great. I want to talk a little bit more about your work in employment first. Now, I did meet you. We found out. Because you were helping Tennessee with the state leadership mentoring program, the Employment First State Leadership Mentoring Program, with the wonderful acronym EFSLMP, which is ridiculous that we would have to say that. So can you explain? That was under the Office of Disability Policy, which is under the Department of Labor. That's a lot of acronyms and a lot of information. But can you tell us what was your role and what was that program?
It essentially started with trying to look at what are states that have, you know, better competitive integrated employment rates doing differently than the rest of the country. And so about a decade ago, the Office of Disability Employment Policy, which, by the way, interesting note, for people who aren't familiar with our work, in the United States, there was not a subunit of federal government solely dedicated to employment and disability until 2001, right? We're only celebrating two decades. And we weren't even counting, with the Bureau of Labor Statistics, unemployment by disability label, right? Wow. We didn't even know what those were. Mm-hmm. So the Office of Disability Employment Policy, with their creative minds, came up with this idea of trying to help states learn from one another, just like we were talking about before. And so we would do landscape assessments. And my big piece for Tennessee was really looking at not only some IPS stuff, there was some of that, but really looking at some self-employment. It was a pleasure because, as you know, Tennessee's done so many great things around removing those barriers at the state level. And so I got to work with the task force. I got to work with individual folks. And then we would create deliverables. And that was a lot of fun. We worked with the Kennedy Center and other partners to deliver that. Unfortunately, Georgia, my own state, came calling, and I had to refocus my energies from EFSLMP back to Georgia, and I haven't done anything with ODEP for a couple of years now.
Okay. You just do so much, and your reach has been so far. And I love the fact that, to me, that you came from a provider agency, right? Because I think that, and that's just very, to me, that's key. And that's where, if you're in this field, you had to have worked hands-on supporting people at some point in time. I know you are a strong believer in evidence-based practices as well. Can you talk about the importance of evidence-based practices and the fact that they're kind of thin in this field? Like, to be honest, I can remember, I've been around for a little while, and I remember, like, we would have complete shifts in how we deliver services, like every 5-6 years, because there was no best practice, there was no research being done at all. It was just based on gut feeling. So I wanted to know if you could talk a little bit about that.
Man, what an insightful question. Well, there was a paucity of evidence-based practices. And so when Dr. Drake and Dr. Gary Bond and the folks at Dartmouth started doing their work in the late 90s, and then the randomized control trials at, you know, the early 2000s, it's important for folks to know that that work has informed so much of what is happening at the national level. But we often say this: we couldn't even as a field agree on what to call a job, right? We couldn't agree on what that even meant. I'm still working with state agencies that debate, should we call the person a client, a consumer, or a job seeker? And so this lack of knowing what works in the research, you're absolutely right. And here's an interesting little tidbit I think you'll love. Dr. Gary Bond and Dr. Steve Hall, who I talked about earlier, have known each other for decades. And so about 5 years ago, Griffin Hammes said, if we're going to impact this system, we've got to mirror what has happened on the IPS side and get busy researching fidelity scales. And so now Griffin Hammes has three separate fidelity scales. One for discovery. It's been published in 5 or 6 different journal articles, more coming. Another one for customized job development. And then this third one that's just recently rolled out in California, all about how do you truly use coworkers and supervisors as trainers and less of a job coach being there for 2 decades on a Medicaid waiver, right? And so that part to me is so fun to watch the inner workings of that behind the scenes. When I get down, right, when I feel like we're not moving enough, I can now say on the mental health side and on the IDDD side, there are fidelity scales, there are evidence-based practices, there's no going back. We know what a job is. We know it helps people. And imagine 20 years ago in community mental health, we would say the person's not ready or at discharge they can have a job, right? It's an aftercare issue. But because of that groundbreaking work, now we say, hey, guess what? To feel good, to recover, to participate in your community economically and socially, you got to have some money, right? You got to have a role.
Yeah.
And I think that's just fantastic.
So, like, I had a physical reaction when you told me that about the fidelity scale. Let me tell you why. So I was a statewide trainer for individual placement and support, which is research-based fidelity, 25-point fidelity scale. So I saw that Griffin Hammes Associates also had a fidelity scale for their discovery service. And I looked at it, I was reading it, and I was like, wow. First of all, this is awesome that they have one. And second of all, it has some elements from IPS in it. And I didn't realize, or some That's influence right. it looked like. And I didn't realize that they yep. literally had collaborated some or had some kind of conversations around it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very cool.
They've known each other for decades. And yeah, it was really neat to see that happen. Absolutely.
Very cool. So the last thing I wanted to talk about officially, although something may pop in my head before then, is that you are a writer. and this isn't like a small phrase. Like, so I'll let you tell us about your writing, but you, my friend, have quite an extensive writing career as well. You're like a Renaissance man. You just do so many things and you're all over the place. So tell us about your writing.
Oh, that's awfully nice. Thank you. It doesn't feel that way, but I tell people I work in human services and I work as a writer and manage to make a meager income. And mostly because we know that it's tough to make money in either one of those fields. But, the writing for me has been just something, sometimes you're just born with something. I can't play any musical instrument, can't sing, can't do any of that. But reading and writing have always been things I've loved. And so, yeah, I have a literary agent in New York City. I've published with Penguin, Random House. I've published with smaller presses like Chicago Review Press and Northern Illinois University Press. My book that's coming out next year is the first book that officially has everything to do with our field. And it's called 22 Cents an Hour, Disability Rights and the Fight to End Subminimum Wages. And that should be out early spring of 2022. And it really looks at our field and this idea that we're still debating after more than 7 decades of subminimum wages for folks with disabilities, that it's still legal federally to do that.
Right.
But it also takes a look at how much lobbying and how much trade organizations and the lobbyists on K Street in D.C. influence our work in our field. And I think that was shocking to me, to be honest, as I started doing the research and a little disappointing.
Right.
But there are 2 bills in Congress now that will hopefully overturn that. But in any case, the other books, which are fiction, memoir, I did do a true crime book about some murders that occurred in Santa Claus, Georgia, that had a lot of addiction and foster care elements in it. But I've always tried to meld together, whether it's from my own family, disability and mental illness and physical illness, in these stories. And I've done the same with the fiction as well. It's just a way to, I guess, cope one way. And then just most recently, which has been fun for me, I've published four short stories in something called Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine, the oldest mystery magazine in the United States. I used to read it when I was a kid, and the one that was included in 2019 has a character with the label of Down syndrome. So I just try to combine those things in ways that can lend itself to storytelling.
So your publisher brags on you a little bit about your, I don't know if brag is the right word. It's like they're throwing a little bit of shade, if I'm going to be honest, towards one of our past presidents of the United States.
Yes.
So you want to explain.
Are you talking about Jimmy Carter?
Yes. You want to tell about this?
Yeah. The first book is called Pig Boy's Wicked Bird. And it's a memoir about growing up on a pig farm in Indiana. And I had two fingers severed in a farming accident as a kid. And, that's kind of traumatic when you're seven. But I was a huge fan of Jimmy Carter. And it was during his campaign. And so then, full circle, 3 years later, I wrote published The All-American Industrial Motel, which is about working with my father in a ceiling tile factory. And true story about his addiction, my addiction, substance use, factory life, which really kind of gives itself away to substance use. And that was a tough book to write. My folks didn't really love it. But my mother, who was always quite a character, found out that it beat out Jimmy Carter for the Georgia Author of the Year Award. And she was fine with it then, fine with me telling the family secrets. But I never, as I say, I never got a call from President Carter saying that he, was okay with me winning. But it was neat. It was a neat thing to happen, I got to say.
It was neat when I read it. I'm like, yeah, that's pretty cool that, yes, Mr. Carter. Yes, President Carter. Unfortunately, I'm a slightly better writer than you are.
He's a great guy.
I do want to step back. You were talking, and I want to know if you can give us a little bit of a sneak peek at your next book. Can you give us one example of how big business has impacted our work? That intrigued me, like, immediately, because I'm very interested in things like that.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, Nave, it was a shock to me. I think we've always known in the field of supported employment and customized employment that we're trying to dismantle the old system, and that's very hard to do. But prior to doing this research, I was pretty naive about how much, particularly trade organizations at the national level and lobbyists, influence it. And so in 2011, you might recall, let me say this. In 2009, the story of the men at Henry's Turkey Service in Iowa was kind of revealed to everybody. These men that were essentially human trafficked from Texas institutions to Iowa to work for pennies on the hour in this turkey slaughtering business. And even as far back as 1978, there were stories about the abuse, but they were not saved until 2009. Some of the men tried to run away, and when they'd run away, the people who owned the business would track them down and bring them back, and on some occasions, chain them to their beds.
Oh my gosh.
Well, that happened in 2009. Yeah, yeah. So this happens in 2009, policymakers, people even who were not in our field, started to say, now, what is this? What's going on with the subminimum wage piece? And so Dr. Mark Maher at the National Federation for the Blind started to think about what role could they take, because they'd been involved in testifying before Congress and saying subminimum wages are a violation of civil rights. And they really felt like, okay, if we got Henry's Turkey Service, this horrible situation, surely that's going to give us some momentum. And so they did a Freedom of Information request and found that Goodwill was paying some folks on the record 22 cents an hour. And so some momentum began in Congress for a bill in 2011 called the Fair Wages for Workers with Disabilities Act. And as I started the research, Nave, I found out that some very prominent names in human services, along with lobbyists and trade organizations, were actually lobbying against something called the Fair Wages for Workers with Disabilities Act. And I was shocked at that. I think for me, the history of bad public policy is certainly seen in what is called 14C, as you know, the Fair Labor Standards Act. Section 14C authorized that you could pay people subminimum wages. But the fact that we're still here in 2021, as we're talking about fair wages for everybody, debating if that should be the case for workers who have been forced to work for subminimum wages, to me is a real shame. I'm not a big fan of either of the bills because it seems to reward the same entities that we're fighting against doing away with subminimum wages. So we'll see. I think there's a lot of debate yet still for those two bills.
Yeah, thank you for that sneak peek. And that sounds like something I definitely look forward to getting my hands on once it comes out. So now is the point of the show where I get to ask a few personal questions. The first one is...
All right, I love it.
Okay. It's so funny. Don't ask me what made me think to ask this, but it popped in my head like a couple days ago, and I'm like, it's the most awkward question, but it's my show and I'm going to ask it.
I love it.
Which is, when is the last time you watched something and cried? What was the last time you watched a movie or a commercial and cried?
That is a great question. Let me see. I got to be honest. I'm a pushover. You know, I'll kind of cry at about anything. I guess I would say, can I say something I've read that made me cry?
Sure, absolutely.
I don't watch that much television. Sometimes documentaries, but I think I'm really touched by memoir, right? And how people tell their stories. And just poetry too, you know, real poetry that you know, not the ones in our Hallmark cards, but really kind of showing what it's like to be human. Mm-hmm. So I'm reading this is going to be a weird answer, but I'm reading a novel right now by a guy named S.A. Crosby, and it's called Blacktop Wasteland. And ostensibly, it's a crime novel. But he is nailing what it means to, I think, live in our culture, particularly as a man, and not being able to cry at movies or something you've read. And so there's a great description in it. Again, the author is S.A. Crosby. He won the Los Angeles Times Book Award for this book. But he's describing seeing his daughter at a gas station. And he doesn't know he's going to see her, right? So she's obviously young adult, and the way he describes it, you got to be a dad to get that vulnerability, you know, to see your child out in the world, but they don't know you see them. And watching that, it choked me up. Yeah. Oh, it's a great question. Nice. Do I get to ask you that question?
You don't want to know the answer.
Yeah, I do. Come on.
It's embarrassing, but you know, hey, we should be allowed to embarrass ourselves. Yeah. So I was watching the Netflix show Stranger Things, and at the end of season three, you know, it got pretty emotional. Ironically, between a father and daughter. And anyway, there's some things that happens. It's sad and I'm bawling, and it's like this, you know, this monster, scary sci-fi show, and I'm sitting here bawling. So there you go. I don't care.
Hey, little tidbit. One, I've seen all those episodes, so it is something I watched. And two, here's the cool thing, Nave, where my wife and I get our Christmas tree every year, that's where they film The Cabin.
Oh,
in that series.
Yeah.
And now you can take a tour. You can take a tour of where they film it. And it's 15 minutes from us. It's in Powder Springs, Georgia. Yeah.
I didn't think I could like you anymore. So how is this possible? This is great. And so my
same here, my friend, same here.
So my last question is, I always like to hear about self-care, and it sounds like you have a lot both in your personal life, and maybe writing is one form of self-care for you. But I was wondering, what is it something you do for yourself that helps you take care of you?
Man, you are good at this. That is a great question. I used to say I run, but it doesn't look like running at 53 anymore. You know, I was in Nancy and I went to Mexico. We'd never take vacations. So went to Mexico, this nice little villa kind of thing. And so I want to get out and run. Right. And they have these beautiful cobbled streets. And, you know, I got pain in my knee and in my back and all that. So I'm what I think jogging. And this young guy stops. And now my Spanish isn't real good, but he was asking me, am I okay? A young fellow was so concerned about the way I was running, he thought I was injured. So definitely some some exercise. But Nancy and I live on a little 8-acre farm in Douglasville, Georgia. We have sheep and goats and cats and dogs and chickens, and that's a lot of fun for us. And just taking care of other creatures, that does it for sure. Yeah.
Nice. Well, Doug, thank you so much. It's fascinating. Okay, so I didn't tell this, and if people have made it to the very, very end. So I reached out to Griffin Hammes Associates, to some of the associates, and were like, hey, could you be on this podcast? Here are previous guests I've had. This is what it's about, blah, blah, blah. They were like, hey, we would love to, but we actually think there's another guy who would be better than us. And then they referred you to me. And then so we write back and forth. And then you were like, Nave, I think we've met before. And it ends up that we have collaborated in the past. So it's a small world. It's a small world.
It is a small world. And, you know, as soon as I connected it, I thought, oh, it makes complete sense. Because you can tell another creative, right? In our field, it does draw people who are creative. And I can only say that you're on my playlist, on my wife's playlist. As I said, she's sending the podcast everywhere, and you are gifted at this, and they are great podcasts, and I'm so, so honored to have a chance to talk with you.
Well, thank you so much for coming and for doing everything, for truly, truly impacting the disability community in all the best ways. And good luck with all of your other side adventures, too. I can't wait to get my hands on one of your books.
We'll make sure that happens. Thank you.
Find links to Griffin Hammes Associates, the work spoken about from the University of Georgia, as well as to Doug's literary page in the episode description. Make sure to follow The Landscape on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, and Twitter. In the next episode, I have a great discussion with fellow podcaster Maddie, who is the host of the podcast Brain Fart. And she also speaks about her invisible disability. We'll see you then.